Well, let's start. If it's 4 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon, I'm Mark Mullinax, and I'm here to lead us into some discussions, perhaps troubling discussions for some of us, about the implications of saying Jesus Christ. Christians have been saying Jesus Christ for 1990 years or 1960 years or so. And there's a group of people that say this is an illegitimate appellation. This week, this is the second of three times that I'll be speaking about Jesus Christ. Yesterday we spoke about how the incarnation of Jesus Christ means a radical, even racy, emphasis on flesh. And we saw yesterday how the Greek categories of thought that were the first categorization and systematization of Jesus and trying to understand him were the kinds of thinking that made Jesus less than human, because it made Jesus more of a divine person. Because it was philosophical language, it was intellectual language, it tended to be universal, and these things tend to steer one away toward thinking in particulars, toward thinking in terms of flesh. And so that has, I was maintaining yesterday that our Greek heritage has cost us Jesus. We have Christ, but we don't have much Jesus. Today, I'd like to continue this kind of view by trying to understand the first formulations of Jesus as Christ and how the Jewish people at the time were thinking about Christ as well. My thesis for today is that Western Christianity has first so far removed Jesus from his own context, and second, not attempted to know how he was understood by his Jewish contemporaries, that our understanding of Christ from almost the start has been a violent understanding. I'd like to repeat that. My thesis is that Western Christianity, which is what we profess pretty much, has so far removed Jesus from his own context, and second, not attempted to know how he was within his own Jewish context and understood by his contemporaries, that our understanding of Christ is largely a violent understanding. And our understanding of Jesus is really, perhaps, an illegal appropriation of Christ with its own internal coherence for us Christians, but one which does violence to those who are external to our understanding of Christ. This is hard stuff to understand, and I want you to promise me that you'll raise your hand if I say something that might not that you might not understand, or you might not agree with, or you just want to have some more time to think about that.
Yes. I presume you're going to explicate what you mean by the word violence, then.
I have. Yes. Okay. Thank you. The place we need to start with Jesus himself. Jesus was not a Christian. Jesus was a Jew. This should be a self-evident statement, but one that is not adequately understood by Christians, I think. So we gloss over a verse like John 4:22 that says, salvation is from the Jews. So this kind of thing is not very often... It doesn't often enter to our consciousness that Jesus was a Jew. This is all what we call, what I call, and what Rosemary Ruther calls, and I'd like to introduce her book in a minute, the left hand of theology, in which the right hand does not know what the left hand is doing. So if the right hand of Christology, which is the study of Christ, understands Christ from a Christian point of view, the left hand of Christology is this negative view of Jesus that does not take into account his Jewish beginnings. Christians have torn Jesus from the soil, the Haaretz, in the Hebrew, of Israel, have torn Jesus from this soil. We have de-Judaized Jesus. We have uprooted. We have alienated. We have Hellenized, as I said yesterday. We have Europeanized Jesus. So that the Jesus we understand today is, according to our pictures in our churches, white, usually fair hair, blue eyes, someone who would probably understand us more than he would understand the times in which he was supposed to have lived. We have even turned Jesus into an anti-Jew, and I will get into that shadowy, dark history in just a minute. This is understandable on one level. Jesus' message in the gospel is almost exclusively to the Jews, to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, to use Jesus' own words. Even Paul could easily say that Jews have misread, or that Jews read Moses with a veil on their face. And this has given us the rationale to see Jews as blind to their own spiritual destiny, blind to their own spiritual heritage. For instance, in the Strasbourg Cathedral in Germany, there's one stained glass window that depicts a triumphant Christ. A triumphant church next to a synagogue, and the synagogue has a blindfold on it. And then even in the Chartres Cathedral, in the so-called Passion window, there's a detail that shows the devil shooting an arrow right into what looks like an eye of the synagogue. So not only is there a veil like Paul is saying, but this veil is also blindness that is irreparable.
But isn't that pretty much a medieval trait of the church? That certainly one can point at Luther's works and find a couple of anti-Semitic pamphlets, you know, out of what he wrote, 50,000 pages or something, you can find 10 that are offensive.
You can find, there's 200 here.
Okay, so, yeah. But I mean, is it fair to indict the church today for what went on in medieval time? I mean, these cathedrals are 500, 800 years
old. Well, let's... Can we address that question later? Let's talk about this, because that's something that I think we need to answer. Is this only in the past, or is it still with us? Yeah, I would like to maintain one answer, but my answer may not be what you would say or what everybody else would say, but so maybe we can have a discussion of that. European history is replete with anti-Semitism. From 1095, just to start somewhere, in the very first crusade, Pope Urban II sent Christians on their way to rid the Holy Land of the Muslims. But on the way, Christians killed Jews by the thousands, identifying Jews as the enemies of Christ, identifying Jews as those Christ murderers. Later on, the Rhineland was made Jew-free. Roman Catholic churches had this Good Friday custom of bringing a Jew to worship and boxing him about the ears to avenge the disgrace of Golgotha. Last evening, Rennie Golden spoke about movements in Europe around the year 1492, movements which included clearing out the Jews from an area and appropriating their land and their possessions. This happened in more than a few places. It happened in England, France, Spain, and Portugal, and most of Germany. And the question needs to be asked, has something happened to fix Christian theology so it might not happen again? This would be going back to your crucial question. If something has happened, what has happened to fix it? With these expulsions came a reduction of Jewish rights, ghettoization, pogroms, trumped-up charges of ritual murders, profanation of the host, things like that. One sad episode, and I'd like to read some from Martin Luther, is that while he began the very important Protestant Reformation with very favorable things to say about the Jews, by 1543, he was very much against the Jewish work, and he has a work called The Jews and Their Lies. And in this is a compendium of some of the most virulent anti-Semitism one could ever imagine. And he ended up by calling for the expulsion of Jews from Germany. And this work also had a great influence in Nazi Germany as well. I would like to read some of these passages. First, set fire to their synagogues and schools, and bury it and cover with dirt whatever will not burn, so that no man will ever again see a stone or cinder of them. This is to be done in honor of our Lord and of Christendom, so that God might see that we are Christians. And do not condone or knowingly tolerate such public lying, cursing, and blasphemy of God's Son and his Christians. Second, I advise that their houses also be razed and destroyed, for they pursue in them the same aims as in their synagogues. Instead, they might be lodged under a roof or in a barn like gypsies. This will bring home to them the fact that they are not masters in our country, as they boast, but that they are living in exile and in captivity, as they incessantly wail and lament about us before God. Third, I advise that all their prayer books and Talmudic writings in which such idolatry, lies, cursing, and blasphemy are taught be taken from them. Fourthly, I advise that the rabbis be forbidden to teach henceforth on pain of loss of life and limb, for they have justly forfeited the right to such an office by holding the poor Jews captive with the sayings of Moses. Fifth, I advise that safe conduct on the highways be abolished completely for the Jews, for they have no business in the countryside, since they are not lords, officials, tradesmen, or the like. Let them stay at home. Sixth, I advise that usury be prohibited to them, and that all cash and treasure of silver and gold be taken from them and put aside for safekeeping. Seventh, I recommend putting a flail, an axe, a hoe, a spade, a distaff, or a spindle into the hands of strong young Jews and Jewesses, and letting them earn their bread in the sweat of their brow as was imposed on the children of Adam. For it is not fitting that they should let us, accursed Goyim, toil in the sweat of our faces while they, the holy people, idle away their time behind the stove, feasting and farting, and on top of all, boasting blasphemously of their lordship over the Christians by means of our sweat. No one should toss out these lazy rogues by the seat of their pants. Well, I could go on.
What volume?
This is volume 47 of Luther's works, the final 170 pages. What's going on here? I mean, this was a shock to me to recognize that this was going on. How can we proclaim Christ in one breath and such anti-Judaism in another breath? The most important book that I've ever read in my 5 years at Union Seminary in New York is this book here. It's printed in 1974 by Rosemary Ruther, R-U-E-T-H-E-R, called Faith and Fratricide, and is subtitled The Theological Roots of Antisemitism. And this is the most important book to me because it's also the most shocking about how my own views of Jesus and my own allegiances to Jesus are sometimes at the cost and expense of Jewish theology. She has a very intricate, sometimes hard to follow, but nevertheless valuable understanding of the earliest roots of this problem. She's saying, I'm going to summarize briefly, that before Jesus was even born in the Middle East, we find two cultural orientations, the Jewish and the Hellenistic, or the Greek one. These were distinct, and the Hellenistic was one that was gaining in ascendancy, and it came to see itself as the norm and the standard for civilized and humane existence. If there were ever a group that refused to assimilate into Hellenistic culture, on the grounds that its gods were false and its manners unclean. This was a cultural offense of a great magnitude. The result was the German word Kulturkampf. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, maybe not. But a culture war. The Hellenism became enforced by leaders such as Antiochus Epiphanes, and struggles for Palestinian independence. Does that sound familiar? The word was already happening at this time. And we see this in the Maccabee Wars and the Jewish Wars, before the Common Era and in the Common Era. So in these wars, the Jews had in this culture war, the Jews, however, had the intellectual upper hand. But the Hellenists had the superior firepower. You see, Jews and their philosophies predated Plato. And Plato is, of course, the godfather, grandfather of Hellenistic culture. But Jews, like Egyptians and the pharaohs, and Hindu mythologies, were all prior to Plato. And Plato saw these three forms of religious expression as more original than his own thought, and therefore he was learning from them. And in Hellenistic thought, there was a recognizable strain that the Torah, the Jewish law, is the embodiment of cosmic law. It is something very natural law. And this cosmic law is the manifester of the divine logos. And if you know anything about Hellenistic philosophy, they're concerned with this divine logos. Plato had learned, therefore, at the feet of Moses, one could say. Jewish monotheism and ethics was attractive to some Greek thinkers seeking a pure and a non-anthropomorphic religion. So Judaism, therefore, could present itself as the original version of a higher philosophy. In fact, Judaism was considered an apologetic, even an evangelical faith in these times, which is very strange to hear, because it was representing itself as a universalist faith. Well, the reaction of the Greco-Roman world to the Jews was ambivalent. Even when the temple was destroyed, however, in 70 in the Common Era, the Jews were pacified. They were not annihilated. And I want you to understand that, because when Christians come along, this policy of pacification is going to end. It's going to start being annihilation. The temple was destroyed not because of anti-Semitism, but because it was perceived as the hotbed of sedition. All the radicals that might have been threatening the Roman Empire were supposed to be congregating there. And so the Romans leveled it, and it was more of a political rather than ideological or religious action. However, it was Christian anti-Semitism that arose as a largely unique factor. Its source lies entirely in Christological disputes. Is Jesus the Messiah? That's the central thing. Was Jesus the Messiah? This dispute brings to it the very core of Christian theology and the very core of Jewish theology. And you have two different stories, and they're competing against each other. The sad truth of Christian history that we find a special virulence against Jewish theology, which translates itself into making the Jewish people devils, considering them masses of damned people, because both of these traditions hold rival truths to the same set of religious symbols. And these symbols are very powerful. You have rival claims to them. Was Jesus the Messiah, or was he not? Now add to all this the Christian and Greek concern for inner meaning, for getting into the spirit of things and not necessarily dealing with the flesh part of things. The irony is that Christianity came about as an apocalyptic religion at a time when Judaism was also in its apocalyptic phase. Which, when I say apocalypticism, that meant that the Jewish people were, as well as the Christians, were seeing a radical end to the world within their lifetime. They were getting ready for the end days. Jesus, many people think today, was among these apocalyptic people going about the countryside, warning people the reign of God was about to break in. Repent, believe the gospel, and then you'll be saved. So it's very ironic that these two faiths have much the same message, but something happened with Christianity that did not happen with Judaism, and we therefore have a problem. Well, I'm going to stop here. I've been throwing out a lot of information, and I'm afraid I may not have been throwing out too well, but I'd like to see if there's any reaction or questions at this moment.
I have a situation in the Old Testament where God is often described in very anthropomorphic terms, having arms and feet and the whole thing. And you have a phenomenon that when the Bible got written down at a later point in time, there were, by that time, in the editors, as it were, people who were offended by this anthropomorphic descriptions of God. And so instead of standing, we will still see it in the RSV, instead of God standing before Abraham, in English it says that Abraham stood before God at that incident of the terebinth tree. The Hebrew actually has Abraham standing there, and there are other places where people got really uncomfortable with describing God as anything but what we would now call a Greek ideal of timeless, omnipresent, omnipowerful, omniscient, all those omnis. And so they tended to talk about the glory of God rather than the hands and feet of God in various. So it predates the Common Era by quite a bit. To what extent is that going on? Is the war still going on between trying to remove God entirely out of this place and stick him up there in heaven where he'll be virtually harmless and out of the way?
That's a question that a biblical scholar could probably answer very well. I imagine that the war is still going on. And
because I think it's the connection of what you were saying yesterday. That in fact, Christians have an idea of Jesus as God made present here. What they've done with that idea is cross it out and put Jesus at the right hand of God up there.
Well, all I'm going to say is that the problem that Jewish people have with Christians, and I'm getting a bit ahead of myself, is that we have radically historicized an eschatological event. So, historicized means that we have frozen what should remain fluid, is another way to say that. We have made the Messiah. This Messiah that was supposed to come at the end of history and wipe out every evil and do all these grand and glorious things that God has promised throughout the First Testament. And Christians say, and we got the upper hand in saying this, and because we said it loudest and longest and with the most support, that that Jesus came in history, the Messiah came in history, and therefore the eschatological has come. The eschatological means how things are supposed to be at the end of time, when God completes and consummates all of history. It's called the eschaton, the final days. So what Christians have done is to prematurely, even illegally, historicize what should have remained eschatological. We have frozen what should have remained solid, what should have remained fluid, excuse me. So this is the heart of the problem here. How that relates to what you're saying, I don't know. I'm going to take a very minimalist view at this. I'm going to stay with that, because I don't know how to react to that other. I imagine it's true, but I cannot verify it. I'm not a biblical scholar. Any other thing? Okay. Well, Christians could have defined themselves not as a new or second covenant, but as a renewal of the one covenant given to Abraham. And only just added, we could have just added only the belief that it will be Jesus who will return as the Messiah in a future time. This kind of Jesus religion that Christians had could have coexisted within Judaism as an offshoot of Judaism, but remain identified as a Jewish faith. But when Christians raised up the Messiah Jesus as a new, superseding figure that brought a new covenant, the break occurred. So Christians, according to the Jews, illegally call their testament the New Testament, because there's a testament means covenant. There's a new covenant. But the Jewish people said, hey, wait, we haven't finished up on the old one, the first one, the original one yet. Christianity, therefore, is characterized as a Jewish offshoot that is unwilling to recognize faith in Jesus with the one ongoing covenant of Israel. Christianity has further separated itself by giving itself sole permission to spiritualize its faith in a Greek fashion and to reinterpret Jewish scriptures with a particular historicized key, that key being Jesus, the Messiah, Jesus Christ. How many times have you read the First Testament and say, oh yeah, Jesus fulfilled this. They're talking about Jesus. Behold, a son shall be given. All of these revelations, all these scriptures that we read during Advent. Go to a commentary sometime and see what the real context of these were. And then recognize that Christians have reinterpreted with a Jesus key, a Christ key. Could Christianity, this is a question today, could Christianity have coexisted with Judaism as a branch of Judaism, just like there are three or four branches of Judaism now? Could there not be a fifth, one that sees Jesus as the primary paradigm for the faith, but not one who has radically become history, radically historicized something that should not have been? Well, the year 70 CE, Common Era, the temple was destroyed by the Romans. Christians interpreted that fall as proof that the Israelite religion is outmoded because it failed to believe that Jesus is Christ. Jewish people interpret that also a failure, but not a failure to believe in Christ, but a failure to be faithful to God. And this is also a theme in the First Testament. Jews have throughout our history marveled at our abilities to survive and grow into the giant that we have become. And they marvel at it because of our contradictory starting point. You see, we appropriated the key symbol of Jewish faith, the Messiah. When the Messiah comes, there's not going to be any more evil. When the Messiah comes, the eschatological end time reckoning that God is going to bring to us will have begun. And what have the last 1960 years been but evil? Anti-Semitic often, massacres, the Holocaust. I mean, people say that this century is one of the bloodiest world, in our world history, but this century is no more bloody than any other. And Rennie can tell you all about that. When the Messiah comes, evil is not supposed to happen anymore. But evil has often been perpetrated in Jesus' name against Jewish people. So, the other side of the coin of anti-Semitism is Christology. Most Christians today seem willing to tame our crudest expressions of anti-Semitism, but few of us are willing to get to the root of perhaps a much more profound problem. The weed of Christology and the tares of anti-Semitism have grown up together from the very beginning, so it may seem impossible to pull out the weed, whatever that is, without uprooting the seed of Christian faith as well. And as long as Christianity and anti-Judaism intertwine, we are not safe from a repeat of pogroms, expellings, holocausts, and other anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic actions. If there's something that's happened in Christian theology that can be widely recognized by Christians as something that is going to prevent another Holocaust that happened in the 1940s, where Jews, because they are Jews, were killed by Christians, good Christians, then I'd like to know what it is. We need to know what it is so that we can identify this. But I'm afraid that there's going to be even more killing in the generations to come of Jews, because Jews have been killed in every century so far just because they're Jews. I don't see anything on the horizon or in our history that's going to prevent that. Maybe you can help me be more optimistic. Well, I've said enough for now. Let's open it up.
Well, in the history itself is what ought to serve as a preventative of that in the future. I mean, certainly, within this two or three generations after the Holocaust, people are certainly sensitized to anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long that lasts, but it wouldn't surprise me if it lasted for 100 years. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Is there a response to that?
Yeah. Two. One, as we look at what's going on in Eastern Europe, right now, we see the rise of a lot of anti-Semitism. Some very violent forms of anti-Semitism rising. And the other is not all that far north of here in Alberta. There's a trial going on of a man named Jim Keekstra, who was several years ago tried and convicted, this is a retrial, of teaching that the Holocaust never happened as a public school social teacher in Alberta. And in the past 5-6 weeks, as dozens of his former students have gone to the witness stand to testify, most of them have testified that he taught them this, and this all happened about 15 years ago. In their meeting time, they have discovered absolutely nothing which has convinced them that he lied to them in any way, shape, or form, that they're still convinced that the Holocaust is a sham and a fabrication.
And it's a Jewish conspiracy to destroy Christianity.
Yeah.
Well, I think there certainly are some cases like that, but I don't think you can take all of Eastern Europe and say that that's proof of something. If you look at, countries like Hungary and Romania, I mean, there's warfare going on there among ethnic groups. And not based upon religion, but national origin.
No, yeah. And you're right. What all I'm saying is that the seeds are still there. The seeds are still there. And there are plenty of people out there for whom that kind of seed is going to fall into very fertile soil. Unfortunately, I'm afraid, much sooner than 100 years. That's, I guess, what scares me. I see it in places where I would think it would be the last place to appear, in groups of people where I would find, you know, we assume that education is how it's going to solve our problems. Well, clearly, the Canadian educational system, which is just as good as the American, hasn't dealt with it in this area at all.
I have parishioners who will come in tonight when there aren't any mean Jews in town. They learned it from their German parents who immigrated before the First World War, before the Second War.
I go back to, revisionist efforts come out of a sense of the expectation of something that should go on in history. You touched on this idea of, Christ Messiah. The disappointment and fulfillment in the historical process of the prophecies of Yahweh, whatever. And where is the kingdom? Your interpretation of Jesus saying the kingdom is near, I heard you talk about that in an eschatological way. It's around the corner. Mm-hmm. As opposed to an existential one like between you and me, as some people interpret Luke.
Right.
Or others.
Already, but not yet.
Okay. But let's just go with the idea for a moment. The question, which is that the sense of acknowledging our Jewish roots, that what you're implying, and I want to check this out, is that Christianity has its own revisionist version, in a sense, of its Jewish roots by calling the New Testament new.
Generally, I could agree. I'm with you.
Okay.
Yes.
So then, what do we do? How do we then interpret our own present, if it is the case, disappointment in history, or the fulfillment of God in history? I think our expectation, especially in the Western mind, has been that there is some built-in value, process, even divine flooding of the historical process for fulfillment. And when we then find evil like the Holocaust and it to happen again in whatever form, we then say, then we become disappointed because our assumption has been that we're getting better, but progressively. So I think it's a problem as to then what really was accomplished in the historical convention, life, or whatever way you do your thing of coming down or coming up or whatever, of Jesus. Of the historical Jesus, vis-a-vis life, mission, suffering, death, resurrection, ascension, and that whole event as a cosmological event, what really difference has that made in our expectation in history? Really. And I think that if we look for evidence of a difference in the historical process, we will be disappointed. So, to tie that to some kind of progressive view or historical understanding is an illusion. Abelin talked about that in his problem of historicity in terms of how do you identify the evidence of revelation in the historical process. Now, I know that's a whole other school of people who really do believe that, but I'm not sure that's the case yet.
I'm not really following you. 4 o'clock is my worst hour of the day. I want you to know that. But I'm having trouble following where you're trying to go with what you're saying.
What I'm trying to go with is that the idea of setting up the tension between the Christ of Christianity and the Messiah of Judaism. The sense of disappointment in the fulfillment of the history, of the holy history. That's all I'm saying. And I'm saying, what is the nature of that disappointment? And what difference has Christ made in that history, in our expectation for the fruits of his mission to be in history, or our sense of disappointment? That's all.
I'm confused too.
I think I'll be more confused. Brenda, can you?
This may not help because he certainly put out a long challenge, it seems to me. I think one of the problems is when you talk about radically historicizing Jesus, I mean, I think it's very clear when you say it's placing the Messiah or God's revelation at a particular historical moment as if that is not continuing.
Yeah.
I think the problem is to say, where is God's revelation now? What is that expression? And what will it require of us? What will it require of us to become part of that revelation? And now, now I have a lot to say about that, but at least it seems to me the most important question is not so much to talk about this sort of frozen moment. I think we all agree upon that. I think the question is that we are ahistorical. In other words, where is God's revelation at this moment? What does it require of us to be placed on the side of God's revelation in history? Now, I'm setting up, I think there's an answer to that, but at least I think that's the sort of problem.
Okay. Make sure we get to your question if we're not getting to it. But the problem to me is not that this was, one of the problems is that it was radical historicized and then frozen as a universal. So that every particular history of anybody had to match up one-on-one with this historicized view or else it wasn't valid. So a universal church, a church in which everything has been laid out and all of theology has been defined once for all as universal, can't make room for particularities. It can't make room for women who want to become priests. It can't make room for Jewish people who say that something else happened here. It can't make room for disagreements. And so I want to say that perhaps we as Christians might recover this if we say that our view is a particular view, a particular understanding of the single covenant given Abraham. It is a separate but equal faith expression upon the Abrahamic faith.
Well, let me ask one other way. So in what sense is the mission of Jesus, his cross, the reality of Jesus, discontinuous with the Jewish history? Where is there any departure from it? Is it a unique event?
In terms of Jesus himself, like I said, he was an apocalyptic at a time when there are other apocalyptic views. It's what Christians have done with that. That is the problem.
So in and of itself, it made no statement.
Jesus?
The Jesus event, whatever, however, wherever you put that. Cradle to tomb, or how. The piece that is historicized and frozen, which I don't see it frozen, hopefully not.
Yeah.
Right. Or contained, or whatever way one wants to speak of that. But one has to see that as a window. And there are other windows. But it is a window. It may be the interpretive window of how one understands history and the move of God in history and revelation today. In other words, I do think that the historical Jesus and his mission and death and resurrection is the interpretive event.
The key paradigm?
Which you use the word universal that I would use, but is the key interpretive event for the window of how we understand the nature of God and God's mission. I mean, that's, to me, the core of the confession of what a Christian is, to say that in the historical Jesus and his mission, death, and resurrection, I see the work of God.
I'm not going to trash that view. I'm not going to trash my Christian heritage. I'm going to remain a Christian. All I want to say is that the Christ story is paradigmatic for me. But I don't want it to be destructive of Jewish ways. Let's put it this way. We could say that in the two testaments, there are two paradigmatic stories. They're separate, but they're equal. Exodus in the First Testament, the life story of Jesus in the second. And both of these ways are an expression of being in covenant with God. And the Jesus one renews that covenant, but it doesn't supplant, replace, supersede, or take over anything that the Jewish had. Because if we're to believe the First Testament, the Jews have all they need to be right with God in the First Testament.
I think the question is not so much does it abrogate the former. I don't think it does. I think it fulfills it. The question is how final is that?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question.
That's, and that's what we're discussing today. And right. we're coming down on different places there. But both, to use a theological word called Heilsgeschichte, both are salvation histories that are particular and not universal, and they both speak to the histories of each one. But if one is to say that the Christian or the Jewish is to supplant the other, then I think that's illegitimate.
So what's the third one?
What's the third one?
Yeah.
Then you get into world faiths. You get into Islam. Islam has its own paradigm.
In our tradition, would the third one be the second coming, or if one uses that kind of language?
I don't think so, because we say that Jesus is sufficient for our salvation. That's just off the top of my head.
The roots, the anti-Semitic roots that we were talking about earlier, I guess. I mean, they're there, I'm sure.
Yes.
I guess I see anti-Semitism, if anything, as being an offshoot of the Hellenization of the Christian church. And it's becoming an exclusive as opposed to a universal.
I don't see much difference between exclusive and universal. In the way that I understand how universal ideas work, they tend to become exclusive.
Then I chose the wrong word in that context. But all the same, I don't see how what you've been talking about has to do with the anti-Jewish. What we were talking about earlier. Is it there?
Yes.
Side point to that. We're using the term universal in a way different from what I've heard it used recently in groups I attend, okay. Where we speak of universalists. Mm-hmm. Universalists are those who say everyone has a different view of truth and life is a search for that. So my job in life is to search for myself while I am very tolerant of all the views in the world. So a universalist, rather than being exclusive, is totally inclusive of all views. Your view, whatever it is very legitimate. Mm-hmm. And I'm on my search for truth wherever I am on that journey. And in that sense, it becomes a very inclusive approach. And I suspect if we're going to get beyond the programs of the past, we have to come to some view like that, rather than say, how do we distinguish ourselves from Jewish, or how do Jews distinguish themselves from Christians? How do we see ourselves as on one planet and on a similar search for truth, whatever that is? I'm oversimplifying, I know.
That sounds to me like a very beautiful position to have. But I think there's a difference between universalist and universal. The other word for the word for universal is Catholic, small c. Universal means the same thing is good for everybody.
What's going to change the Christian path that allows and encourages almost the anti-Semitic view. I haven't heard anything in the discussion to say, where's the change in history?
No. I don't think there's been a change in history yet. I just don't sense that something's happened in our faith yet that will allow us to. The things that I'm engaging in are Jewish-Christian dialogue, in which people come and talk about what's important to them, how they view Messiah and these categories of thought. And then, even though minds may not be changed, at least they'll know the names of people who have said these things, and you're much likely to have heard somebody with a name. You know, that kind of thing. So. Yes?
Well, I mean, this is just to sort of push this question about how anything changes a bit more. It seems to me that in both of these traditions, we're talking about prophetic traditions. And whether it's Yahweh or Jesus, the expression of God's revelation is found, it seems to me, in both of the first and the second story, amongst the poor and the oppressed, the dispossessed, those who have been excluded. This is where God's revelation is expressed. And so the task, it seems to me, for Christians, if they are to be faithful to their tradition, for Jews, would be to challenge any triumphalism, to challenge any, you know, to make a particular choice about who they accompany. In a sense, in political terms, in terms of the civil society, whose side are you on? That, to me, it seems, is a faith choice. And I say that, you know, for Jews that would oppose Zionism, or for Christians that would oppose, you know, capitalism and the Western view and that which breaks the backs of the poor. How do we stand up to racism? Capitalism, to this particular, these isms which are sins. And so it seems to me that the prophetic challenge is to say, how do we place ourselves with those who are the nobodies of history?
That's
so that there's a link between when the right is in ascendancy as it is now. It's not, there are all kinds of scapegoats, and there's a link. The right always makes a link, symbolically, even if nothing's connected. So the Jews are scapegoated. People of color are scapegoated. Women are scapegoated. Certain ethnicities are scapegoated. Homosexuals are scapegoated. And they're all part of this sort of demonic. And the real question is, how do we stand with those who have been cast out?
Read Matthew 25.
Right.
Well, I appreciate your saying that, because I my heart aches for the belief and the expectation that we can make a difference. And we work hard to make a difference. You know, some people, some spend their whole life attempting to make a difference. Mm-hmm. Over and against the demonic.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, not to give up, mm-hmm. but in the whole understanding of whatever we call salvation, or healing, or hope, or wholeness, or whatever language one uses to describe the outcome of grace and love and forgiveness. How do we read that out in history? And I feel sometimes in working with people that they count on seeing the evidence of that coming out, the fruits of that to come out in the historical situation. I am too, with a particular person, invest myself in it, whatever. I think the source of liberation theology, so-called or whatever, has mysticism, the recovery of mysticism, has been an attempt to try to deal with a sense of profound disappointment of the church, of the gospel, to deal with historical change. That's one way to see it. Doesn't mean we don't do it.
Okay. On that note, let's call an end to our hour, and those who want to stay around and wrestle some more, I'll be glad to stick around. I thank you for coming and wrestling with a very difficult topic. I promise next time it'll be much more even cut. We'll speak about Asian views of Jesus.
It was a good one. Thank you.
Thank you.